Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of Ernest Moniz, President Obama's choice to be the next Secretary of Energy. Tyson Slocum, the Director of the Energy Program at Public Citizen, joins us to discuss the choice of the physicist who is currently Director of MIT's Energy Initiative, a research group that gets funding from BP, Chevron, and Saudi Aramco. Then, with the publication today of the new list of billionaires from Forbes, we will speak with Les Leopold, the author of a new book, How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth. Now that the Republicans have again gone to the mat to protect the tax loopholes that allow hedge fund managers to accrue astonishing wealth while paying less taxes than their secretaries, we will discuss what it is that hedge funds do and why they are able to pull down astounding sums of money. Then finally, as counting begins in the Kenyan elections, we will examine the revolving door between the political classes that rule Kenya, often inciting violence to further their power, but ultimately taking care of themselves and not the voters they promised to take care of. George Zongola, a professor of African and Afro-American studies at the University of North Carolina, joins us to discuss the lack of ethnic violence so far compared to the last election, which could change as election results are announced. And joining us now is Tyson Slocum, who's the director of the Energy Program at Public Citizen. He works on promoting decentralized, sustainable energy and providing affordable, clean energy solutions for working families. Tyson Slocum has expertise on federal subsidies for the energy sector and promotes refocusing such incentives away from the nuclear, oil, and coal industries towards efficiency, renewable energy, and mass transit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tyson Slocum.
Hey, always great to be here, Ian.
And the announcement today of the new Secretary of Energy, Ernest Moniz, who was a deputy energy secretary during the Clinton administration, apparently, and heads up a research shop, I guess, at MIT called the Energy Initiative, which gets funding from BP, Chevron, and Saudi Aramco, even though this funding is supposed to be connected in some ways to climate change. There's a bit of a paradox to begin with, isn't there?
Well, I mean, that's the paradox of the Obama administration, right? Where, on the one hand, the president employs some soaring rhetoric about how important it is to address climate change on one hand, and then on the other, for example, in his State of the Union address, he emphasizes his all-of-the-above energy strategy with a big focus on vastly expanding oil and natural gas production. And the problem is you cannot address climate change at the same time that you increase fossil fuel production. And so in that sense, Moniz is a perfect fit for Obama's contradictory energy policy. Again, Moniz is a great person personally, he is the wrong pick to be Secretary of Energy at this critical time when we need to focus our energies not on promoting natural gas, as Moniz has said we need to do, but instead on promoting decentralized renewable energy and arming citizens with more tools to help us use energy more wisely and make rooftop solar and other decentralized renewable energy more affordable. You know, Moniz's comments about how natural gas needs to be the centerpiece of a clean energy strategy is going to take us backwards. There's too many emissions involved with natural gas production and combustion, and we're investing billions and billions of dollars in new drilling when we need to be investing in safe, sustainable, renewable energy systems instead.
So when the president says, as he did today, that Ernie knows that we can produce more energy and grow our economy while still taking care of our air, our water, and our climate, can you have it both ways?
You can. And as you said at the beginning, Mr. Moniz ran an institute at MIT in Massachusetts that got tens of millions of dollars in seed funding from major oil companies. And this is a big strategy by big oil to influence the academic process, to finance the research activities of major academic institutions where they're studying things like the safety of fracking and other things. And that's seriously problematic. Again, Mr. Moniz is a fine individual, and I wish him luck in academia, but he is the wrong person to be leading the Secretary of Energy at this critical time when we need people that are not committed to fossil fuels, but committed to clean energy, to renewable energy, and promoting energy efficiency.
And where was Stephen Chu, his predecessor, in this? They're both physicists, both nuclear physicists, as a matter of fact.
Right. I mean, Stephen Chu was the head of one of the Department of Energy's many illustrious research laboratories. And Stephen Chu ended up being, focusing heavily on promoting nuclear power, focusing on promoting renewable energy as well. But he clearly wasn't the right fit to administer such a large agency as the Department of Energy. Again, Stephen Chu is a fine individual, but the problem I have with Obama's nominee, Moniz, to head up energy is he's a status quo candidate at a time when we cannot afford the status quo.
And, of course, he was famous for investing in Solyndra, which was a company that made solar panels that got on the wrong side of technical innovation and cost the taxpayers a considerable amount of money. And, of course, the Republicans have been making hay out of it ever since. Do you think is this new candidate, is he likely to be gun-shy now as a result of Solyndra?
No, actually, because Moniz is a huge proponent of nuclear power. And there is the Obama administration has extended an $8.3 billion loan guarantee offer to Southern Company to build a new nuclear power plant facility in Georgia. Now, negotiations were not going very well on that loan guarantee, and the Secretary of Energy would oversee the details of that loan guarantee plan. The negotiations were not going well until after the inauguration, and it's important to note that Southern Company gave $100,000 to finance Obama's inaugural activities this past January. And weeks after that $100,000 check was delivered, a Southern Company executive announced that the loan guarantee negotiations were going very well and that they expected it to close before June of this year. So Moniz has been a huge proponent of nuclear power. We have Southern Company that gave $100,000 to Obama's inauguration is set to accept an $8.3 billion loan guarantee. I'm sure a lot of listeners out there can understand the return on that investment. $100,000 turns into $8.3 billion. And the problem is that nuclear power is extremely risky. The Southern Company project is already over $1 billion over budget, and it's already more than a year behind schedule. This is the wrong technology. It saps a lot of money that should be going to proven cheaper technologies like wind and solar and investment in energy efficiency.
Again, I'm speaking with Tyson Slocum, who is the director of the energy program at Public Citizen. He works on promoting decentralized, sustainable energy and providing affordable, clean energy solutions for excuse me, for working families. Tyson Slocum has expertise on federal subsidies for the energy sector and promotes refocusing such incentives away from nuclear, oil and coal towards efficiency, renewable energy and mass transit. And we're talking about the new choice of Ernie Moniz to be the Secretary of Energy. And he is a nuclear physicist. He's worked as a member of the Obama administration's Commission on Nuclear Waste, and he's heads up a think tank at MIT, the Energy Initiative, a research group that gets funding from BP, Chevron, and Saudi Aramco. So I guess this report last Friday from the State Department about the Keystone XL pipeline, which disappointed a lot of environmentalists, could be a harbinger for the new Secretary of Energy to announce Keystone. Is that where we're heading?
Well, I mean, it's not surprising that the Obama administration came out with a favorable environmental review of the Keystone pipeline. As I'm sure many of your listeners know, the Keystone pipeline is this proposed system that would link up dirty Canadian tar sands oil, move it through the Midwestern United States down to oil refineries in the Gulf Coast, where that tar sands oil would be turned into gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel, primarily for export out of the United States. So we're moving Canadian oil through the United States to a coast to get it out into the global market. That doesn't benefit consumers. In fact, research by my organization, Public Citizen, shows that it's going to result in an increase in gasoline prices for Americans. What it is also going to increase dramatically is greenhouse gas emissions, because tar sands oil is far more carbon intensive in terms of the extraction and the burning. It is unsustainable. It is a serious problem for the planet, but the Obama administration remains committed to this all-of-the-above strategy, and the problem is we cannot afford this all-of-the-above strategy. It's more of the status quo, and the status quo is what's led to climate disruption. We need to get serious about climate change, and approval of the Keystone Pipeline cannot be part of that.
So if you are somewhat skeptical that the new Secretary of the Energy is going to come out on the right side of Keystone, what about the new head of the EPA, Gina McCarthy, who was also announced today?
Gina McCarthy's great. I've had the pleasure of meeting her in her office in her current capacity at the EPA. She's a tremendous individual, and I hope that she's able to run the EPA. The question is Gina McCarthy going to get the support she needs from the Obama administration to deal with climate change? As your listeners may know, in 2007, the Supreme Court ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency must regulate greenhouse gas emissions under its existing Clean Air Act authority. Now, Obama, to his credit, used that authority for the first time in announcing last year finalized greenhouse gas emission rules over automobiles. It was a combined fuel economy and greenhouse gas emission standard that actually is very good, but the work is not done. We need to then get rules on existing power plants and oil refineries, and that's where Gina McCarthy comes in. She's a great a leader at the EPA, and she needs to have Obama's support in this year proposing regulations over existing power plants and oil refineries, emissions of greenhouse gas emissions. So that's what we need from this EPA. I think Gina McCarthy's ready to do it. The question is Obama ready to do it?
And what do you make of the questions, Tyson Slocum, about Ernie Moniz's chairing a panel on the future of natural gas, where he was against erecting barriers against exporting natural gas, and that seems to be something that people are watching closely. If indeed
for good reason, we shouldn't be exporting this gas because, first of all, if we export natural gas, that's going to raise prices for the companies and the individuals that are using that gas today. But second, if we start exporting this gas, it is just going to encourage more fracking domestically here at home. And fracking has serious environmental, climatic, and water issues in terms of pollution. And so we've got to understand that fracking is not part of a clean energy future. It is not part of addressing climate change. It is a barrier to a clean and sustainable future, and it inhibits our ability to effectively address climate change. And the problem I have with Moniz, again, he's a fine individual, but he is not the right person to be leading the Department of Energy at this critical time. We cannot have someone in there that is a cheerleader for fossil fuels like natural gas and fracking and oil. And that's what Moniz is. I think that he's been fine in academia, and I wish him well in his continued academic pursuits. I do not want him to be Secretary of the Energy at this critical juncture. He's the wrong person for the job.
But, of course, the argument that that those that have been promoting natural gas and energy, U.S. energy independence, is that it's so much cleaner than coal. And there's no question that coal has had to take a back seat, has it not? Because natural gas has become so cheap by comparison. So
absolutely, we've seen a displacement of coal-fired generated power plants in favor of natural gas, primarily because of the cost advantage of gas. And there's a secondary benefit to that, because natural gas, as you said, features significantly lower greenhouse gas emissions when you burn it. But the problem is the methane emission leaks at the fracking wellhead sites where you're extracting the natural gas are significant. So while natural gas has clear advantages over coal when you burn it in a power plant to generate electricity, there are serious emissions problems when you're fracking, when you are extracting that gas from the ground. That's why gas is not a solution to climate change. In fact, it's a contributing problem to climate change. The only solution here is focusing on zero emission sources like wind and solar. The technology is there, right? The question is, do we have the political will? And we have to remember, Moniz, his program at MIT is bankrolled by big oil and natural gas companies. So his perspective comes from big oil's perspective. If George Bush had nominated Moniz, every major environmental group would be screaming and hollering, talking about how big oil is now back in charge at the Department of Energy. We haven't seen that with Moniz. Again, I don't mean to disparage his character. He's a fine person individually. He's just not the right person to head up the Secretary of Energy at this critical juncture.
And there's nothing in what was said today or in his resume that indicates that he wants to accelerate wind and solar?
I mean, he talks about wind and solar the way that Obama does, as part of an all-of-the-above strategy where wind and solar play a role, typically a backseat role, to oil and gas. And that's the problem I have. Moniz is going to promote the status quo. He's going to accelerate development of natural gas. And that's what he's going to be promoting. Of course, he's going to talk about wind and solar, but what we need is someone to say fracking is not a solution. Increasing natural gas production is not a solution. It's a problem. There are hundreds of communities out there that are experiencing pollution and water contamination as a result of natural gas. This is not a clean, sustainable energy source. This is a devastatingly polluting resource. We need to understand that the future of our planet depends upon sustainability, and sustainability comes from zero-emission sources. The technology is there. The question is the political will. We have to stand up for the fossil fuel interests, and when a Secretary of Energy nominee has the financial backing of big oil companies, that's not my candidate. That's not the person I want in there.
Well, Tyson Slocum, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's always my pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Tyson Slocum, who is the director of the energy program at Public Citizen. He works on promoting decentralized, sustainable energy and providing affordable, clean energy solutions for working families. Slocum has expertise on federal subsidies for the energy sector and promotes refocusing such incentives away from the nuclear, oil, and coal industries towards efficiency, renewable energy, and mass transit. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the author of a new book, How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth.
Energy is becoming one of our country's greatest concerns. If we don't stop working on energy conservation, there may not be enough energy to go around by the time I'm a parent. I'm going to learn about how we can solve some of our problems through alternative energy sources. You can learn more about energy, too. Call your county cooperative extension service for more information. Conserving energy is everyone's responsibility. Call 4-H to find out how you can do your part.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm joined now by Les Leopold, who is the co-founder and director of two nonprofit educational organizations, the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute. He designs research and educational programs on occupational safety and health, the environment, and economics. He also serves as a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations. And his latest book just out is How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth. Welcome to Background Briefing, Les Leopold.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So there's a connection here, I guess, the fact that today Forbes released their list of the top 100 billionaires in the world. And here you are with a book, How to Make $1 Million an Hour. There's got to be a connection.
Oh, there's definitely a connection. But there's an even bigger connection to the obscene level of inequality that we're facing in the country right now. What got me going was that I calculated that the top hedge fund earner, and this was in 2010, earned as much in 1 hour as the average American family makes in 47 years. Think about that for a second. Somebody gets in 1 hour what it takes a family a lifetime to earn. So the question led me to start thinking about, well, what do these people do? And are they doing anything that is remotely useful for the economy or for society? And what I was hoping to do is get us outside this framework where we say, okay, there's rich people and poor people, and we should, you know, obviously tax the rich people more to help the poor people not be so poor. But it's always assumed that the rich people's richness is legitimate. But we don't examine how it is that they attain this money. And so this book is what turns out to be an indictment about how these super rich people end up getting their wealth.
So tell me, how does a hedge fund work? It's obviously other people's money, but how can they make so much money so quickly? and presumably make money for their clients as well as for themselves.
Well, let's define what a hedge fund is. It's an investment fund, and it can invest anywhere in the world using any kind of technique it wants, and it's only for wealthy people. You can't invest in a hedge fund if your income has to be over $200,000 a year, and you have to have at least $1 million worth of net worth. Your wealth has to be $1 million or over. So it's really a plaything only for a super rich. And what they do is they find ways to make interest rates that are interest returns, you know, investment returns that are way beyond anything that the rest of us can imagine. They want double-digit returns. They want 10, 20, 30% a year returns on their money. And the way it works is the hedge fund manager, he gets 2% of the money at a minimum, just when you give it to him, and then he gets 20% of the profits that he can generate. So the question becomes, well, what do they do to generate those profits? And as I start to push into this, I just couldn't believe what I came up with. I mean, I think the rest of us would basically say that they make their money by cheating. A lot of what they do on a day in and day out basis is ethically suspect. Some of it's actually illegal, and most of us would find it incredibly ethically suspect. And what we did is we set up the book as a kind of how-to book, tongue in cheek. So each chapter is another step on how you can make $1 million an hour. And most of the steps are about how you can skate out to the ethical edge and beyond. And some of them just completely blew me away. I had no idea that this is what they were doing. I think the readers will be amazed.
If you have to, your clients expect double-digit returns on their money, over 10%, because, you know, banks pay next to nothing nowadays, and so do T-bills and municipal bonds. So how do you, if that's the kind of yield that they expect, they're not looking at long-term investments. They're not looking at what capitalism is supposed to do, which is to nurture companies and develop products. They're just looking for where they can make the most money the quickest, isn't it? Isn't that what's going on?
Yeah, you've got me laughing, because one of the techniques that certain hedge funds use is called high-frequency trading. And they have these supercomputers that they situate right next to the stock market, so they get the feed from the markets in nanoseconds. And they're able to figure out what the rest of us who don't have this high-speed technology are going to do. So in a sense, they can predict the future. But one of these guys that I'll get into that in a second, but one of these guys that is doing this has not had a losing day in 5 years. And for him, a long-term hold of a stock is 2 seconds. He never holds a stock for more than 2 seconds. And what they're able to do is they will make like 1 million trades a minute, but they withdraw them. So they let's say you're on E-Trade and you're trying to make for your 401k, you're trying to make an investment. By the time you press the button, between that time and the time the trade goes through, a high-frequency trader has bought the stock that you want to buy and sold it back to you at a slightly higher rate than you thought you were going to pay, a few pennies more here and there. Those few pennies add up to 5 to 20 million, a billion dollars a year. It's a hidden tax that they're taking from all the other investors. And as far as I can tell, it's a entirely useless activity. It should be completely wiped out. But yet there are, you know, billions and billions of dollars wrapped up into this. And that's, look, if you can, it's a can't miss proposition. It's a wonderful way to get a high rate of return for your millionaire investors. That's one technique. There's your long-term hold to help the capitalist economy.
Well, as you know, Leslie Appold, we're at a point now where, again, the Republicans have gone to the mat for the billionaires. And what is going on with this sequester, and of course, unfortunately, our press is so slavish in terms of covering both sides of the story that it's not really clear, which it should be, how cynical the Republicans are in deliberately destroying the economy and reversing the slow recovery in order to destroy Obama's presidency. That is the stated goal of Mitch McConnell, and he is the one who's holding up any activity in the Senate to do anything about the economy and this sequester. And this, the Republicans have managed to somehow tell the American people through our disgusting press that this is all about not raising taxes, when nobody is talking about raising taxes on working Americans or the middle class. They are only talking about raising taxes on hedge fund managers and closing these loopholes, like this carried interest loophole that allows them to pay so little tax, as we learned from Mitt Romney's tax returns. This is what the racket's about, and yet the entire government of the United States has been held hostage to the handful of billionaires who the Republicans are prepared to go to the mat for. I don't understand why this is not made clear to the American people, and how criminal and irresponsible and petty these Republicans are in terms of their insane hatred of Obama and their determination that he is a failed president.
Everything you say is true. But I think the reason that we're not seeing the kind of attention to the very issues that you're talking about is because the Democrats also do not want to go after these hedge fund guys. When I was putting the book together, I tried to get a statement from Timothy Geithner about a financial transaction tax, and his office gave me a statement totally opposed to it, thinks it's a bad idea, but of course it would put the high-frequency traders totally out of business. There's a congressman in Colorado, Congressman Jared, who's extremely liberal, and he has like 100% AFL-CIO rating, and he and another liberal congressman sent a letter to President Obama in support of the carried interest loophole, which allows these hedge fund people to pay then it was 15%, now it's 20% tax rate instead of the normal, they should be paying 39% right now. So you have this, unfortunately, you have co-conspirators. I'll grant you the Republicans are totally trying to destroy President Obama. But when it comes to taking on Wall Street, to change the conversation, you have to take on Wall Street. Wall Street should have been the central piece in this discussion about the sequester. How did we get here? Why are we talking about having to tighten our belt? Because Wall Street took down the economy. And that was a symbiotic relationship between hedge funds and big banks on Wall Street. And they literally tore a hole, a gaping hole, out of the center of the economy. We tell that story in the book, but also part of that story is, you know, you have Senator Schumer from New York. He's the senator from Wall Street, and he's the number three person in the Senate. So we need to change it. We need pressure from the outside, and we had it for a while with Occupy Wall Street, and now it faded. And if you notice, the conversation before Occupy Wall Street was about the grand bargain and austerity, and then when Occupy Wall Street hit, it was about the 1% and the 99% and the problems from Wall Street. And as soon as Occupy Wall Street was repressed or faded or whatever, however you want to say it, the conversation went right back to austerity. So a positive people's movement makes an enormous difference. I don't think we can depend on the Democrats to do it for us, I'm sorry to say.
Well, that's true. But I mean, the only people that are doing anything for us happen to be Democrats, like Elizabeth Warren.
True.
Elizabeth Warren is the person who came up with the financial transaction tax and the other day.
And there are others. There are others, yeah. I grant you. The thing is that we have to create a big enough fuss so there's more. What's happened now is that, in a sense, the Tea Party controls the conversation. The Tea Party, Ayn Rand right wing, has pulled both parties to the right, and we need more progressive resistance. And to get there, we one of the goals of this book is we have to delegitimize the way these super rich people get their money, because we have a tautology in this country which goes something like this. These people are rich, they're smart, and if they're rich and smart, it must be that they're producing value for the economy because they're rich and smart. And it just goes around in a circle. And nobody, and they walk on water. They give big donations to Central Park and in New York and to the museum, public library, and they're philanthropists, and everybody's, kissing their butts. And no one's, and in a sense, they're the modern day pirates. And we're, letting them go unscathed. So we have to do some delegitimizing. We have to ask the question: show us what you do that is of value for you getting all this money. Because we have a term for this in economics; it's called an economic rent, which is another word for ripoff. And in fact, I think that's what's going on here. They've used loopholes in the system to literally siphon off our wealth. They're not creating value, and that's part of the struggle, which I think will help in the bigger struggle that you're describing. I think they're connected.
Again, I'm speaking with Les Leopold, the co-founder and director of two nonprofit educational organizations, the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute. He's the author of the new book just out, How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth. And we're talking to him on the day that Forbes came out with a list of the top 100 families in this country, starting out with Carlos Slim of Mexico, followed by Bill Gates in number two. And then third, by the way, is Amancio Ortega from Spain, with a value of $57 billion. And of course, the Spanish economy is in free fall. There's over 55% unemployment amongst the young, and go figure. I mean, this is, you can see this financial engineering that's going on to feed and concentrate more and more wealth in the hands of fewer and fewer people. It seems to be happening globally. It's not just an American phenomenon.
Oh, no, it's obscene. And, the major financial players here and in Europe developed the games that, mutual policies on both sides of the ocean that deregulated finance set this in motion. See, high finance, the hedge funds, set the bar for compensation for all the other CEOs, both financial and non-financial. I mean, if some 35-year-old guy's making $100 million a year doing these games, and here he's got 50 employees, and you've got 50,000 employees, you say, well, hey, I want to make a lot of money too. So we've got to pull down the top, the tippy top. In a hurry. If we have the time, I want to give you one more example of one of the biggest ways that these guys made some money during the crash, or right after the crash. Imagine the following: I am going to sell you a house, but I've designed the house so that it will catch fire and burn to the ground within 6 months. And without you knowing it, I have taken out an insurance policy on the house. So I'm going to get paid when I sell you the house, and then I'm going to get paid again when the house burns to the ground. Now, that seems to be unethical, at the very least. I can't imagine that taking place anywhere else in capitalism. I mean, there's planned obsolescence, et cetera, but that's not the same as having the product blow up in 6 months. But that's precisely what happens between the big banks and the hedge funds in the midst of the housing crisis. They designed products that were designed to fail so they could take out the insurance against them, and then they pawn that stuff off all over the globe. And all the big banks got caught doing this. There was government investigations. Goldman Sachs and the famous Abacus case had to pay a $550 million fine. But the person that they colluded with, the hedge fund guy that they colluded with walked off with $1 billion, and didn't have to pay it back. And yet what they were doing was designing a product based on high-risk mortgages that was designed to fail. They put the worst stuff in the package, told people it was a good package, and then were waiting for it to blow up so they could collect the insurance. Now, that seems to me, whether it's illegal or not, is irrelevant. That shouldn't happen. That should not happen. And we have no chance of doing anything about the income distribution ever if we're going to allow that kind of stuff to go on. So this book is designed to try to help us all understand the games that these people play and increase our outrage. Did you catch this thing about the payday loans? Did you catch this?
No, what is it quickly?
My God. There's 15 states have payday loans is basically loan sharking, right? Where you
sure.
give somebody a loan on the payday and then you charge 500,000-600,000% interest, basically. And, you know, every state in the union has usury law. No place allows higher than a 25% interest rate. And 15 states have banned this practice entirely. So they moved to the Internet. In order to operate on the Internet, they need banks to process the money so they automatically can take it from the victim's accounts. So the J.P. Morgan Chase, amongst other banks, got involved as basically being the clearinghouse for these illegal loan sharking companies, right? So because they're circumventing, they're operating in states without illegally. So why would they do this? Why would J.P. Morgan Chase possibly get involved in loan sharking? Well, catch this. This is the part that'll just kill you. They do this because inevitably the victim ends up, and they're usually, you know, low income, single moms, you know, living on child support payments, but they have a bank account. Well, they inevitably overdraw, right? So because they overdraw, J.P. Morgan Chase can get those extra fees. So they end up like, taking $600-800 a month out of this person's account in overdraft fees.
Wow.
So you've got a double whammy. You've got,
this is one where
The Sopranos would be embarrassed to have this kind of loan sharking. I mean, you know, Tony Soprano would blush over this.
Well,
double whammy.
Thanks so much for joining us, Les. Again, I've been speaking with Les Leopold, the co-founder and director of two nonprofit organizations, the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute. He designs research and educational programs on occupational safety and health, the environment, and economics. He also serves as a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations. His latest book just out is How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the Kenyan elections, which so far have not been mired in violence. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is George Angola, who's a professor of African and Afro-American Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the author of The Congo from Leopold to Kabila, A People's History, and he contributes regularly to The Guardian of the UK. And he's the past president of the African Studies Association of the United States and of the African Association for Political Science. What do you make of the elections in Kenya, George? There's certainly considerably less violence than the last time around, but it's very difficult to separate out the politicians as peacemakers or or troublemakers? I mean, how do they strike you?
No, the violence that has been reported so far does not seem to be the work of the major political candidates. The violence has been reported in Mombasa and Garissa is due, one in Mombasa, to a secessionist group, but is showing its discontent for what they see as control of the land and the coastal areas by big people from the rest of the country, namely the Kikuyu and Kalenjin from central and western Kenya. And in Garissa, this has been an area of discontent by the minority Somali groups in Kenya who feel that they are being neglected by the government. So the violence so far, which has been reported, some 19 people killed, does not seem to be really tied to the elections per se. It's simply people using the election as an opportunity to express their discontent. You remember that the last time the violence came after the results were announced. We haven't gotten there yet, so we just have to hope that this time around the elections will not be marred by post-electoral violence.
And what do you make, though, of Uhuru Kenyatta's, who's the scion of the political family? He's been accused by the International Criminal Court of financing death squads. So that's, at least on the surface, sounds pretty serious.
Yes, it sounds serious. But the point is that people in Kenya do believe that it is a bit unfair that Uhuru Kenyatta, a Kikuyu leader, son of the first president, the founding president Jomo Kenyatta, and William Ruto, a Kalenjin leader, should be singled out when all of the political parties, all of the major political parties, did engage in violence. Uhuru is a member of the Kikuyu ethnic group, to which President Mwai Kibaki, the man who stole the election in 2007, belongs to. And there are reports that the Kikuyu militia Mungiki was founded by money coming from the presidency. So why isn't President Kibaki being pursued by international justice? Why aren't other major political parties, including Raila Odinga's Luo group, being pursued as well? So there is some feeling here that the international community seems to pick and choose, but they're not really consistent in going after all the people who have participated in unleashing violence in Kenya.
Well, of course, there's also the extent to which Kenya is being used as a surrogate for the U.S. in Somalia. How much is that affecting, or to what extent are perhaps the U.S. authorities turning a blind eye in terms of monitoring this election and putting more pressure on the political leaders to tamp down the violence, if indeed there's a useful arrangement going on with Kenya to use their soldiers in an attempt to pacify Somalia?
I don't think the U.S. Would really care who is in power. They can very much collaborate to whoever is going to be the president, whether it is Raila Odinga, the current prime minister, or Uhuru Kenyatta, the current deputy prime minister. They can work with all of these characters, as they did with Arap Moi and then Mwai Kibaki before them. The Kenya's intervention in Somalia certainly is a major cause of what we saw as violence in Garissa. Garissa, as I pointed out, is a northeastern province. It is the capital of northeastern province, and that is a ethnic Somali area. And the ethnic Somalis are very much displeased with the regime. I was there in the summer 2011 as a member of the African Union, African Peer Review Mechanism, and we met with the population in a public meeting, and people were very, very displeased. They were expressing their discontent openly. And so there are militia groups associated with Somali extremists who are eager to unleash violence as part of this discontent.
So, again, I'm speaking with George Jangola, who is a professor of African and Afro-American Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the author of The Congo from Leopold to Kabir, A People's History, and he contributes regularly to The Guardian of the UK. And we're talking about the elections in Kenya and the portent of violence yet to come, even though things have been considerably calmer than the last round, although, of course, as George pointed out, the violence came after the election results were disputed. There is nevertheless, we're talking here about a political class, are we not, George, in terms of, of entrenched political interests, whatever party they belong to. There seems to be an enormous gap between the political class and the average Kenyans. Is this just something that has evolved over the years that's entrenched, or is there a possibility of to have some real representation in terms of the vast majority of the people living in these shanty towns who seem to be caught up in kind of tribal violence?
Well, at the present time, the democracy movement is very weak in Kenya. As we can see, the political class is made up of people who have gotten rich over land, and over government resources through corruption, and they are basically the same characters. Look in the last elections, Raila Odinga, the current prime minister, was an ally of William Ruto, the Kalenjin leader. Today, William Ruto is the running mate for vice president for Mr. Uhuru Kenyatta. So you have, in the last elections, the post-electoral violence pitted Kalenjin against Kikuyu. Now the Kalenjin and Kikuyu, through the supposed leaders, are allies. So you see that the people really have nothing to do with this question of violence. It is the politicians who are responsible for violence, because they're the one who bring these hatreds and who try to mobilize people behind their own claims to power. So the hope is that Kenya would be able to mature into having a popular democratic movement, but it would do something to get rid of this whole generation of leaders who base their pursuit of power and ethnicity, to get people who are more concerned with the plight of the people and who are willing to unite Kenyans rather than divide them.
Well, my understanding is that the most popular television show is a satirical show involving clay puppets that play the various political leaders. And as you know, there was a debate on Al Jazeera of these candidates. But the truth of the matter is they said nothing beyond platitudes. And apparently, apparently in the cartoon version, they really nailed them in the sense that it's just a bunch of hollow platitudes.
Exactly. This is what we have. And this is, I think, the main weakness in African politics today is the fact that ordinary people do have the illusion that if someone from their ethnic group or their region is in power, they're going to benefit. All evidence so far in the last 50 years shows that that is not the case. The educated people like me, yes, we can benefit if someone from our ethnic group is going to give us government jobs, government contracts, and so on. But ordinary people, by and large, do not benefit, really. And so it is very important, it's incumbent on we intellectuals to be able to press that message, make people understand that it is in their interest to disregard allegiance to these politicians and work with those leaders who are really committed to national unity and national integration.
So what is the role of the press in this situation, George Jangola, in the sense that one would expect the press at least to be the advocate for democracy and for the people's voice here? My understanding is that there's a system of patronage that trickles down both through the political world and into the journalistic world. But is there any hope there, any movements towards empowering people through information?
But, you know, one thing you have to remember is that the written press is read by a very small minority. Most people do not have the money to buy newspapers. So the major medium of information are radio and television. And now one of the most disturbing developments in Africa is these private radios, some of which are being used by opportunists to spread the hate speech and so on. But there is an encouraging development that civil society organizations, NGOs, are becoming more vocal and are even bringing some of these people to court in terms of violating the Constitution and violating the law on hate speech. So I think that little by little, things are improving in terms of radio and television not being able to spread division among the people. But for the written press, it's going to be a long, long time because the readership is very limited.
So that has echoes, of course, of what happened in Rwanda, the use of the radio in particular by Hutu extremists to bring about the genocide against the Tutsis. And of course, that has all evolved into an ongoing tragedy in the Congo. But tell me, though, is that are we talking about that kind of...
No, it is not. It has not gone to the level of Rwanda. As I said, you know, civil society has been playing a very positive role in fighting against this type of behavior. And Kenya's judiciary is really improving, especially with the appointment of Tunga as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who is a very, very well-respected jurist and a human rights crusader. And we're seeing that the judiciary getting to play really a very positive role in fighting against this kind of thing. So I think that in that area, Kenya is making some progress.
Well, just in closing, George Zangola, what is the role of the African diaspora here in the United States in terms of improving the politics, if indeed, as you've characterized them, it's a sort of club of an elite that have a kind of revolving door, and even though they manipulate tribal violence, they essentially they basically take care of themselves and the political class first, and the people are essentially being manipulated. And one would think that the diaspora here in the United States may well have a positive role to play.
I hope so. Unfortunately, I don't know much about the Kenyan diaspora, their organization here, but speaking for my own country, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, we tend to be very, very united, and you seldom find a Congolese intellectual or professional here in the U.S. Who would be supportive of his little ethnic group or his little region. We tend to be more nationalistic. We look forward to uniting the people rather than dividing them, and we are very critical of those politicians who want to divide our people and create situations of violence.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, George Zangola.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with George Zangola, who's a professor of African and Afro-American Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the author of The Congo, From Leopold to Kabila, A People's History, and he contributes regularly to The Guardian of the UK. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.